Welcome to the Displacement Urbanism podcast series, hosted through the London School of Economics. My name is Dr. Romola Sanyal, and I am Associate Professor in Urban Geography at the Department of Geography and Environment here at the LSE. In this podcast series, we explore how cities and displacement co-constitute each other. As we see millions of displaced people moving to cities and millions of people displaced in cities around the world, the questions of how these processes intersect are crucial. In this podcast, I will be interviewing a range of actors, including those who have been displaced in different ways and those who are involved in the management and the study of displacement. We will be going around the world to explore the different issues around this topic. I hope the podcast offers an opportunity to open up conversations around the politics and processes of displacement and urbanization, the different ways it can be experienced, understood, and approached. I also hope that the podcast demonstrates how these are global and interconnected issues, but also one that draws our attention to its local specificities. Welcome, everybody, to today's episode of Displacement Urbanism. Our episode today is titled Pushing Back Against Status Quo, How Local Actions Are Challenging the International Humanitarian Regime. I'm delighted to introduce our speakers for today, Samer Saliba and Helen Yu, who lead the development and delivery of the Mayor's Migration Council's City Practice Portfolio. They oversee the $10 million Global Cities Fund for Migrants and Refugees and are managing an active pipeline of projects across over 25 cities. Previously, Samer served as the urban lead at the International Rescue Committee, while Helen was an urban and environmental planning expert with UN Habitat. Together, they have directly advised over 100 cities on issues related to the inclusion of migrant and displaced communities. Welcome to the podcast, Sam and Helen.
Thanks, Romola. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So I wanted to start by asking you, given your extensive experience, what you think are some of the key issues in humanitarianism today and how you think it's impacted by urbanization.
Thanks. I can start with that one. Both Helen and I are actually coming from city planning disciplines, Helen being landscape architecture, myself being urban planning. And so us even being touching on humanitarian issues is unique, right? Because international humanitarianism doesn't typically rely on people who have urban planning practices in their expertise. But because, as some of your past guests like Jeff Crisp have really talked about, the world is becoming more urbanized, so too is humanitarianism and displacement. More and more refugees and migrants are finding themselves in cities for a number of different reasons, which I would recommend your listeners listen to Jeff Crisp's podcast in order to get more of the details about why that's happening. But when I came into this space in 2015, there was very little understanding from the humanitarian side of things about how humanitarian actors should operate in cities, given that the majority of refugees were living in those types of environments. And at the same time, city governments were being pushed aside to respond to displacement in their own cities, despite the fact that they had long-term plans, programs, policies, and even services that could be applied to this population to make sure that they're more inclusive, right? Focusing more on the international humanitarian side of things and also how that relates to international development work, there's just been a tendency since even the founding of the general concept of humanitarian intervention that it's a sort of top-down swoop in, provide life-saving support. And that's just simply, you know, that's the case certainly in emergency settings. But it can be viewed as neocolonial behavior when looking at the face of displacement today, in that it's top down, in that it's leaving out cities from responses to displacement in their own jurisdictions. And it can create parallel service delivery structures where international humanitarian organizations are providing services that are run in parallel to what a city government is meant to or may otherwise already be providing. So we're challenging that now at the Mayor's Migration Council. When I was at the IRC, it was trying to get country offices to work with cities as equal partners. Now I'm very happy to say at the Mayor's Migration Council, I work for cities, as does Helen, as does everybody else on our team. The Mayor's Migration Council is an organization that's led by mayors for mayors, and we'll get into a little bit more into that in this podcast. But we're really trying to challenge some of those issues that are starting to come up in how this international status quo is really perpetuating neocolonialism behavior, marginalizing city governments from their own responses, and missing a chance for long-term development and unlocking displacement as an opportunity for urban growth in a way that is really going to be defining cities, let me say, into the future.
Thanks. I think that that's a really nice way to start this conversation. So, since you were talking about it, I wanted to just ask you then to get a little bit more into your organization and talk about what the Mayor's Migration Council does and how it addresses some of these issues that you were outlining.
So the Mayor's Migration Council was founded after the signing of the Marrakesh Mayor's Declaration, essentially mayors committing to implementing the global compacts on migration and for refugees. So this is particular to cities because this is the first time that mayors themselves are really signing up to actions within cities around displacement. So we have a leadership board made up of mayors from around the world, including from Amman, Freetown in Sierra Leone, Bogota, Colombia, San Antonio, Texas. And these mayors help guide a coalition of over 200 cities in response to displacement and with migrants and refugees in cities. So the Global Cities Fund for Migrants and Refugees is a unique fund that sits within the practice branch of the Mayor's Migration Council. Maybe something important to mention around the work that the Mayor's Migration Council does is that it's a circular model between practice and policy advocacy, where our practices within cities help to fuel the voices of mayors within international fora to help direct additional resources to city governments to do work within the migration and displacement space. As Samer mentioned, this kind of dual, or what we see sometimes in cities, is this parallel delivery system between humanitarian or aid agencies on one side and city governments on the other side. And so, something unique about the Global Cities Fund is that the work within cities is intentionally streamlined between humanitarian and aid organizations and the city government itself. So, the Global Cities Fund was established as an emergency fund during the COVID-19 pandemic, so only a few years ago, but has since grown to supporting both financially and through technical resources, city governments in over 25 cities around the world. And the idea behind the fund is that we directly channel funding to city governments. This is really unique within the humanitarian and aid ecosystem, as well as development ecosystem, actually, and really working on this kind of streamlined process to avoid parallel service delivery, but also to help support the public sector and more sustainable resourcing and the continuation of projects for displaced communities, either through conflict, disaster, et cetera. And the channeling also encourages city governments to work directly with their displaced and migrant communities. So we really fund projects that are co-designed between city governments and displaced and migrant communities, as well as receiving communities. So this is more or less an area-based approach where city governments are working across the city oftentimes, but particularly in marginalized areas that also benefit receiving communities. And we can get a little bit more into some examples of what this fund looks like in practice. That's the Mayor's Migration Council and Global Cities Fund in a nutshell.
Thanks so much. So actually, can we in fact talk about some of these examples and how they work in practice? And I'm wondering whether while you're talking about this, if you could also talk about some of the challenges perhaps that you've seen that have come about.
Sure, I can give one example, and maybe Helen can, with her own favorite. We all have our own favorites among our over 25 grantees. I mean, I'll start with Beirut. And again, Helen talked about how it's not necessarily an emergency fund, but it does work with some cities that are dealing with fragility. So in Beirut, Lebanon, obviously it's a city that's dealing with a number of different crises, from displacement to economic downfall to even recent bombardment from the Israeli government. But we funded Beirut as one of our first five cities of the Global Cities Fund during that sort of response to COVID-19 to very simply, come up with a municipal mobile health clinic operated by the city in partnership with UN Habitat, intentionally focused on vaccinating and testing and also providing blood drives and other health services, not only to the Lebanese in Beirut, but also Palestinians, Syrians, Iraqis, et cetera, et cetera. I highlight Beirut because that's a city that a lot of international humanitarian actors work in. My own organization worked there directly. And I was always just sort of off put, to put it frankly, about knowing how many resources were going just to overseas staff, paying for folks' apartments, all these other things, when that resources could have been better spent if it was going directly in the hands of local responders in Beirut. So as one of our first cities, we granted directly to the city of Beirut. It was their project. In most cases, we're putting the money directly in the bank accounts of city governments. But the other reason why I wanted to highlight Beirut is that if we had done that in the city of Beirut, which was possible, given the economic situation, the value of the dollars that we placed in their bank account would have plummeted almost immediately. So instead, we work with UN Habitat to manage the funds on behalf of the city of Beirut. And that's actually also a good example of how international actors can work hand in hand with city governments to implement city government priorities. And so the clinic vaccinated and served, I think, over 2,000 people in the grant timeframe. It is now a permanent fixture of Beirut's public health services. It works directly with university hospitals. It works directly with other partners. And we saw the clinic really mobilized and playing an instrumental role, however, unfortunately, in helping Lebanese internally displaced given the recent conflict in Lebanon. And that was 5 years later. It was really encouraging for me to see that a very small investment at the start of the Global Cities Fund could have this long of an impact even after the fact. And in fact, 90% of our graduate cities or grantee cities are continuing their projects after their grant closes, sort of speaking to the value of directly investing in city governments and how it can have a lasting impact. And to speak to some of the challenges, it is hard to put money directly in the bank accounts of city governments, right? I get it. But the value far outweighs the cost, in my mind, of making sure that I don't want to get too specific because it can get kind of boring, but like the due diligence and the reading past grant reports and making sure that the staff are in place in order to implement. We do all of that, right? Like we have a pretty robust due diligence system. And that's kind of the point that we're trying to challenge, is that there is a due diligence system and that system is meant to decipher and to say whether or not there's a level of trust there. And too often, you asked about challenges. One of the challenges from the international perspective is there's a lack of trust from the international side. There's an assumption that city governments, particularly in fragile contexts, are not fit for purpose to lead displacement responses in their own cities. And that's an assumption that needs to be challenged head on. The way that we do that is through a selection process and through due diligence and et cetera, et cetera. But I will say that, the number one question I get is like, how do you test for corruption? And how do you, like, you're coming at me when you ask that question with your assumptions that have been cooked into your mind over however many years you've been working in the international humanitarian system. And I need you to start checking those assumptions by asking these questions and figuring out how you can take a more localized approach. And that's the behavior that we're trying to model through the GCF. And yeah, sometimes it's hard. Sometimes it takes longer than it should. But for the most part, we're finding solutions through to actually find ways of working with these cities and building that mutual trust. What's your favorite, Helen, or one that comes to mind?
I don't like calling them favorites just because I think so many of the cities have done such a fantastic job, especially given that, I mean, at the end of the day, $200,000 is not a huge amount for many of the challenges that city governments face, not only in terms of providing services to migrants, refugees, and marginalized receiving communities, but really in helping to support development aims at large, which most of the projects that we funded also do. So we like to say that city governments are excellent multitaskers and that when you resource them, they're not going to spend precious dollars on one particular end goal, but really kind of work across sectors, both in social impact work, but also in energy, environments, waste management, children and caregivers, housing. I mean, you name it, we have city projects that have focused on these cross-sectoral foci. One amazing example of that is in Accra in Ghana. So Accra's project really crosses many of the sectors that I just mentioned. It was a direct response to many of the migrants and displaced people that they see in the city working in the waste sector, kind of helping to segregate recyclables and reusable materials from waste material. Unfortunately, this work is extremely hazardous. And so the city, as part of their Global Cities Fund project, help to form waste cooperatives where people are more mobilized for both collective labor and also the cooperatives help migrants access national health insurance through the Ghana card. And another component of this is really a two-generational approach to supporting their migrant population that is within the waste sector. So as I mentioned, a lot of this work can be in hazardous environments, and the city built a childcare center in order to support the children of waste workers. In just kind of addressing or giving an example of how granting to city governments can actually help to institutionalize some of the support that's provided in across the humanitarian development sector. In learning from this project, Accra Metropolitan Assembly is also in the process of creating a migrant help desk. And so this is in combination with IOM. As Summer mentioned, in Beirut, the city is working with UN Habitat. Kind of on the back of this grant, the city of Accra is working with IOM. And I guess this is really helping to show or demonstrate the continuity of providing financial support to city governments directly, and that they can continue their projects after their grant period ends, or their Global Cities Fund grant period ends, let's say.
Thank you both. Those are very re interesting examples, and I just wanted to ask, how are you able to do this kind of work or encourage city governments to have projects that support refugees and migrants where perhaps there might be, social divisions and so forth, and animosity towards migrants and refugee or displaced communities? Some of us have studied this quite a bit. Several people who've also been on the podcast have written about it as well. So I'm curious to know from your perspective, how do you get to do this kind of work?
Look, I'm not gonna entirely sugarcoat it, maybe a little sugarcoat, but obviously there's a lot of cities in countries that xenophobia is high, social tensions are high, and there's just not the willingness at the national level or at the city level or even at the community level to provide this kind of welcome. In fact, I would say that social tension exists in every city in the world where there's some sort of diversity, period, right? Like social tension is just a norm of having a diverse urban community. But at the same time, you don't have, particularly with, when talking about migrant and refugee communities, folks who have crossed the border to get to a place. You're dealing with border regimes and visa issues and registration at a national level, and cities do have a role to play in facilitating those pathways, but they're not as beholden to it as national governments or regional governments might be. And that creates an opportunity at the city level to treat anybody who's living in the city as simply a resident of the city. And a lot of city governments are, because they're so close to their communities and the demographics of their city, et cetera, they recognize that there's an opportunity to be had. And really, they have two choices, whether it's to just sort of say this is a challenge and we need to deal with it as a challenge, or recognize it as an opportunity and that this growth is going to be normal as it has been for our city. And the majority of cities that we work with, maybe there's some bias cooked into our working model. I don't think there is. We've worked with hundreds of cities. They tend to be on the more opportunistic side, right? These are folks that we need, that we know we need to provide services for. Providing services to them is actually an opportunity to provide services to all of our marginalized communities because those challenges are shared. There's a willingness to think creatively about how to do that. I think Helen's example about Accra is a good one in terms of, these folks were providing waste management services informally, and providing a service to all residents of Accra, and the city recognized that as a way of actually providing them greater security of their livelihoods, greater protection from potential exploitation, plugging them better into the city's formal waste management system, and protecting their public health and protecting the education of their children, right? And now that's a model that other cities are going to try to build off of, which is really exciting.
But I think there's a misconception that providing governments support to then support migrants and refugees is going to be received in the same way, regardless of the level of government. And we've seen a huge difference between kind of, I mean, as we all know, in many of the countries that we live in, stark difference between national government politics and local government politics. And so, I mean, that's really the impetus behind the Global Cities Fund, is providing many quite progressive and socially inclusive city governments with the resources that they need to, in many cases, actually combat the xenophobia at the national level.
A really good point, actually. I wanted to just close this really fascinating conversation by asking the both of you what you think should be done by different actors in relation to urban displacement, given everything we've talked about. So what's the ask here, really?
Yeah, we could do a whole other podcast on the asks. What we're trying to do at the Mayor's Migration Council, and specifically with the Global Cities Fund, is replicate model behavior that we hope the international community, particularly humanitarian actors and development actors, can then replicate. We cannot help every city in the world. We're not a city network. What we're trying to do is more change the system, right? About how international humanitarian and development aid is delivered, and even in as we grow, how national humanitarian and development aid is delivered within specific countries. So, what does that take to change the system? I don't know. I ask myself every day. I don't know I joke that if you look back in a year's time, folks in our industry will say nothing's changed. We're just still having the same conversations. But if you look back in a 10-year time frame, which I have the privilege of doing, I can say that the conversation is shifting. Even the term localization is trending upwards, although it's been around forever, and still less than 1% of international humanitarian funding is reaching cities. At least we're having the conversation. And what I would like to see more of is having the conversation translate into action. Having folks who believe in localization and want to test it and see if it works, put their money where their mouth is and directly invest in city governments in the same way that we're testing through the Global Cities Fund. I'm going to single out an organization because I think they're fantastic. It's the Hilton Foundation, which is one of our core donors. They have directly funded several of our city government grantees after they've funded us to sort of test out projects at a smaller scale. We've given Addis Ababa $200,000. They've come in and given them over $1 million. We've given Barranquilla $200,000. They've come in and given them over $1 million. And they're sort of using us as a test case for their own direct support to local organizations, not just city governments, actually, but also refugee-led organizations and others, and really modeling the behavior that we hope all donors start to work with, start to model. All of our donors are just as amazing as the Hilton Foundation. They're, investing in us and then also turning around and investing back in cities, but they're mostly in the philanthropic sector. We have some government donors who are fantastic, such as SDC, who are also modeling behavior. But we need the US government, we need UK government, we need the EU to really start to trend more and more and more in this direction. And then we need multilateral development banks to come in with the big bucks and actually start to invest, not just in infrastructure projects and not just at the national level, but really thinking about the social dividend and how cities can grow in an inclusive way. So not just bridges and roads, but more inclusive health services, more programs that are focusing on inclusive economic inclusion and job readiness and entrepreneurship, et cetera, et cetera. That's the scale that we hope to get to, right? We're $10 million now with the Global Cities Fund. We hope to reach $1 billion in terms of the influence that we're starting to channel, because that's how much money is flying around, let's be honest. But like the smallest fraction of a fraction is going to city governments who are doing this work regardless of whether or not they have the resources, but can really hit the ground running and really scale it up in a beautiful and meaningful way should they have that level of resources. And I'm talking at a global level, not just, the 25 cities that we work with. So that's a big ask, but it starts with challenging the assumptions. It starts with people starting to do this in a much more sophisticated way than we're currently doing. But again, we're starting to put our we have been putting our money where our mouth is in order to show that these actions are meaningful, however small, however modestly they start off. These actions are meaningful, and now we're really starting to show the dividends of that and the business case, which is where we hope to do more research. But the return on investment for these dollars and how that systems change can really, really expand and maximize that return on investment of investing in cities for them to invest in migrant and displaced communities.
Well, thank you both. I think this is really interesting, and I thank you, for sharing your work and your experiences. And I really like the way in which you've been, sort of getting us to think about what are the kinds of assumptions that we make, in relation to city governments and the ways in which they work with different communities, whether they're migrant or displaced communities. And we know that these categories themselves are also highly slippery. So I think it's a really important point that you're making here about, getting the funds to the governments themselves for them to be able to put forward the kind of work they think is important in bridging those relationships and having inclusivity and kind of building social capital and social networks. There's a lot to think about over here. I feel like, again, there's like lots of different things that we could talk about in relation to some of the points that you've raised, but I wanted to thank you both again for joining us for this podcast today. Really appreciate the time that you've given.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us, Ramona.